And the topic of wisdom has been on my mind for about a week or so. And Monday evening, we had kind of a discussion period on the topic of wisdom. And mostly I asked questions and people gave their different points of view about what they thought wisdom was and how it operates. And I thought today I would try to give a little talk on the topic of wisdom. And as I've been reflecting on it this last week, it seems to be a topic that just keeps growing. And the more I think about it, the less I think I know about it. And the more it seems to be so all-encompassing, especially when you look at the Buddha's teachings and the role that wisdom plays. It's quite common for people to know or say that Buddhism is a wisdom tradition, and that the two primary wings that keeps the Buddhist path and practice afloat is the wings of wisdom and compassion. And so maybe it's important to think of both of them as being paired together and supporting each other, that compassion is as important as wisdom. And in fact, I hope that people's experience of Buddhist practice is one where they get compassionate as much as they get enlightened. So wisdom is one of the two wings of Buddhism. And but what is it? What is it to be wise? What is wisdom? The word for wisdom is prajna in Sanskrit, panya in Pali. And it's one of those beautiful words. I think it's beautiful. I like kind of Indo-European connections between words. And to know that the word prajna, the root of it is jna, J-N-A. And pra is a prefix, which is a kind of intensifier. So it's intense or special or deep. Jna. and jna means to know. It's the root for the word to know. Jnana is one of the meanings of the word. And the word jna is directly connected to the English word gnostic, where they have G-N. The J has become a G, and you get G-N for gnostic instead of jnana. It also connected to the word, same reason, to the word know in English. It's the J has become silent as a K for us. And it's a word that we're somewhat familiar with already. So special knowing or deep knowing or knowing with an oomph is prajna. You find in the translators of Buddhist texts into English will translate the word prajna or panya in different ways. The most common way is as wisdom. But you find other ways, some of them which may be not so helpful and some which are very intriguing because they're so different. I mean, you have things like knowledge. It's also a dictionary definition of prajna. It can include knowledge. Just you know something really well. Some people have translated it as reason, be able to reason things out, or good reason. You find, for a while, the common translation was discriminating wisdom. So a certain kind of wisdom that involved discrimination, being able to discriminate between things, make distinctions. A very famous Tibetan scholar of Tibetan Buddhism, I've never understood his writings. He has all these his own vocabulary for these things and for everything. So Gunther, he translates prajna as analytic appreciative. I forget the last word. Analytic, appreciative, discrimination. And the word appreciative is very important for him because wisdom is value-based. It's not just simply seeing things in kind of as they are in and of themselves, but it involves assigning some value, understanding some value in the discriminations we make, in the analysis of what's going on, the distinctions we're making. Lately, the translation that I'm in most fond of, because partly because it's new for me and therefore evocative and helps my reflections on this topic, is the word discernment, to translate prajna as discernment, to be discerning. And as we go along, I'll describe more about why I think this is so interesting and useful translation, and perhaps an accurate one, or at least one of the accurate ones. But as I thought about it this week and looked at the texts and stuff, I see that the word wisdom is very broad and encompasses many different aspects. And so a single definition or single word wouldn't do justice to all the different ways in which the word is used in Buddhism. However, again, to come back to this idea that Buddhism is a wisdom tradition, you find a lot of emphasis on insight, understanding, wisdom, discernment, discrimination, knowledge. As these kinds of words are very important in the Buddhist path. They come with the Buddhist path. And then you find kind of the opposite. You find words like ignorance, which is kind of the big problem that Buddhists are often trying to address. Ignorance and desire, ignorance and attachment or clinging. And the two are, you know, closely connected. But ignorance then is the problem that's being addressed, and wisdom is a solution for that. In the Dhammapada, a very famous text, the contrast there between a wise person and a foolish person. And none of us want to be foolish, of course. And so the idea is practice helps us become wise people as opposed to someone who's foolish. And there's like some like five or six different synonyms for wise and wise person given in the Dhammapada. It's such a centrally important thing that someone who's deeply practiced becomes someone who's wise. Wisdom or panya, prajna. Before I kind of go in some of the meanings of the word, there is also a list of three kinds of wisdom, which is not doesn't really define wisdom, but defines how wisdom is acquired. And the tradition gives three. There's Chintamaya Panya, which is the wisdom that comes from our own thinking, our own ability to reason and think and work things out. And some people have greater ability for that because they either apply their mind more than others or because they have a natural ability to think and reflect. And that ability to reflect and reflective wisdom is a very important part of wise living. And some people simply don't give themselves time to reflect deeply about things. And I find, you know, going for a hike, for example, alone, or sipping a cup of tea. There's many ways, you know, or journaling or something. There's many ways in which we can develop our reflective abilities and use our powers of reflection to cultivate wisdom and understanding. All these are very important. One of the theme for yesterday's one-day sitting kind of that we had, I tried to emphasize the importance of having undirected time. That many of us, what's happened, many people have commented, one of the things that's happened in modern culture especially, is that people no longer have idle time, very little of it. And there's, for a lot of people feel constantly they're going, there's not enough time to do all the things that we could do. All the projects, all the things, all the recreation opportunities, all the things that, as if doing things has become all important. And it's nice to do things. Most of the things people do, I suppose, are nice things to do. But what's been lost is something very inefficient, which isn't, it doesn't involve doing things, but rather it's the idle time, which the idle time or the sacred leisure or the empty time is often a time when the inner life, the psyche or whatever, can replenish itself or kind of process itself or work itself out in the way, very vaguely perhaps, in the way that dreaming, you know, perhaps is a way in which the psyche kind of organizes itself or processes things a little bit. And you know, what an inefficient, you know, that's, if we really want to be efficient, we wouldn't sleep. You know, we just get more things done. And but we're forced to sleep, and luckily we are, and so this idle time of sleeping is a time when this inner life can do something. And a wise life is also one that I think allows a certain amount of sacred leisure, idle time. And those words may be very inadequate because sacred time, like the Sabbath was a sacred time where we don't do work, don't do things, so that the inner life can unfold, unravel, reveal itself, and perhaps some deeper wellsprings of compassion and love and intimacy and peace, wisdom, can show itself. Because I believe that there's tremendous wellsprings within us of wisdom and peace and feelings of fulfillment that can bubble up inside of us if we get out of the way. But if we're always doing, and having a directed mind, we can't. That we don't have access to that. So having reflective time, I associate with kind of this sacred time, this idle time. You go for a long walk or something, or spend quiet time sipping tea, and you bring something up in a very easygoing way to reflect on, to think deeply about. Very, very important part of a wise life. The second source of wisdom is suttamaya chinta, which literally means the wisdom that comes from hearing things. Because in the old days, they didn't have books. So you learn by listening to someone. But now we have books, so maybe we'd say the wisdom that comes from learning, whatever source of learning we might have. And this involves, getting a book, listening to a Dharma talk, or listening to people that you respect, and then taking in what's being said and reflecting on it more on your own, but really going outside of your own innate abilities to reflect and getting help, getting support. Other people who've thought deeply about things will, have certain perspectives that are helpful. It might take you, 4 or 5 years of research to be able to understand some things that you can just pick up a book from and someone has already studied this and thought deeply about it. And there's lots of wise books. Since I was going to talk about wisdom today, I just had happened to have near me, next to my bed, manuscript of Sylvia Boorstein's latest book. She sent me the manuscript a year ago or something, and so it's all these sheets of paper, and it's called "For Goodness Sake, Pay Attention." Is that what it's called? For goodness sake, pay attention. She's this wonderful kind of, grandmotherly type woman, for goodness sake, pay attention. You just feel her love, not this strict kind of authoritarian approach, but this love. For goodness sake, pay attention. And she has a whole chapter on wisdom there. So I looked at it since I was going to talk about it. So much of how her teaching occurs is through stories. And beautiful stories of people she encounters and the exchanges they have. And she thinks of herself as a storyteller, collecting these stories that somehow express wisdom. So I thought, I should come be able to tell a story too. I don't have any stories. Like the way Sylvia has stories. She's a magnet for them. But I have a story. I don't know if it's a good one, appropriate. But this is my wife told me this story yesterday. She was reading a book, and I was actually very moved by the story. I kind of teared up a little bit. And I think it was a letter, it was a little account, personal account of a woman. From the story, I had the impression that probably she lives in the inner city in Philadelphia, and some parts of the inner city in Philadelphia are among the most violent in the country, with gangs and all that. Somehow she found out that her son was in a gang, and there were three big gangs in the neighborhood, and they were fighting each other and killing each other off. And she also had somehow discovered that her son somehow was on the list of people next to be killed. So that was of concern for her. And so she'd also had somehow picked up from somewhere that many of these young men in gangs came out of dysfunctional families. And so she said, if they had a more functional family, then maybe they wouldn't feel a need to be in a gang, which is kind of a surrogate family, perhaps. So she invited her son's gang to come and live with her, in her house. And so all 15 of them showed up, and they took her up on it. And she started feeding them and doing nice things for them. And apparently there was a surplus of food that she gathered around. And so these gang members then were instructed, you have to do something with a surplus of food. And so they're given something to do. They went out in the neighborhood to people they knew, their family, or whatever, people who needed food, and started giving food away. and started feeling really good about themselves. And they had this nice, you know, feeling, this woman, this mother was taking care of them. And they got so good that one of the rival gang, one of their leaders or something, was in trouble. And so he came and asked if he could go live there too. And then it was apparently so successful, this thing, that she actually got money from the city, because it was actually cheaper to pay her some money than it was to whatever else way. And eventually she she was able to buy this big building and had kind of a halfway house. And the title of the little chapter was called something like Home with 3,000 Sons. And so here's someone who, you know, the best of her ability, she's very motivated, and the best of her ability used the knowledge, the understanding she had, and tried to kind of, she had to do something, so she used whatever knowledge she had and tried to address the problem. And to me it's a beautiful story of, you know, a wise woman, a compassionate woman who acted in the world. And so that's my attempt to tell a story, you know, to convey some wisdom. And so the wisdom that can come from listening, from learning, and learning from other people's stories, listening from other people and their life stories, and from reading texts, and many ways in which we can learn from others. Then the third form of wisdom is called bhavana maya panya. And bhavana means cultivation or practice. And this is the wisdom that can come from our own practice, from practicing. And this is the wisdom that can only come if we practice. There's a lot of wisdom that can come from life experience and from acting in the world. And it's, I don't know if it's, you know, good or bad, but it's certainly humbling to realize that there are a lot of people who, how to say it carefully, there are a lot of wise people in the world who have become really wise without having done any practice, Buddhist practice. And a lot of people have been practicing Buddhism for a long time. They don't have a lot of wisdom. That there's a lot of wisdom that comes from just life experience and reflecting deeply and taking the risk and the chance to engage in life, so that life then helps us to learn more and to discover more. I think of wisdom coming in part from taking risks, like this woman took risks. And but then there's also the wisdom that comes from practice. And for Buddhists, this is a very important part. But it comes from practicing. It comes from engaging in practice in some way. And then the practice in return brings wisdom. So what does wisdom mean? What is it when it arises out of practice? What does practice mean? So there reminds me of another list where wisdom appears. And that's the list of the three trainings. There's sila, samadhi, and panya. There's ethics, meditation or concentration, and wisdom. And it's usually understood that the training in wisdom is supported on a foundation of a training in ethics and a training in concentration and meditation. So that wisdom is something that you need to have some respect for the cultivation of wisdom. And the way you respect it is understand what it takes as a human being, the kind of foundation you need to create for yourself, the kind of preparation you need to do in order to approach this sacred area of wisdom, this very important part of life. And so ethics, living an ethical life, becoming to some degree virtuous, or acting virtuous at least, so that settles the mind, makes it more sensitive, the heart and mind. And also develop concentration, steadiness, stability of mind, stability of psyche, stability of the inner life. If the inner life is not stable in some way, it's very hard for wisdom to arise. One of the things that this woman provided the gang members, perhaps, was a sense of stability, of a home, a place, and maybe her stability, that they could relate to. The psyche also needs to have some stability in order for it to kind of, all its agitation and worries and fears and aggressions, to somehow be able to settle down and be able to look at that honestly. So we need to find some way to bring some stability. And that's another reason for some sacred leisure time. For always living directed lives, doing, running around, and then it doesn't not conducive to cultivating inner stability. Meditation is one of those ways of developing stability. So on the foundation of ethics and meditation, concentration, then we can look into cultivation of wisdom. So what is wisdom? What is the cultivation of wisdom? One of the first, one of the more very common definitions of wisdom, which was given last Monday when I asked people, was the ability to see clearly how things actually are. And the assumption in Buddhism is that most of us, as we live our lives, don't actually see things as they actually are, but we see things through the lens of our preferences, our likes and dislikes. We see it through our lens of our desires and our attachments. And we see it through the lens of certain filter of ignorance, of not understanding how things actually are. So so to cultivate the ability to see clearly, to be able to separate out our interpretations of events from events how they actually are in and of themselves, to be able to discern the difference between, you know, all kinds of things. So, this comes to mind now. I don't know if it's a good story, but it's very brief. We have this newborn baby at home, and he's just over 2 months, 2 weeks old. And so far, we've been blessed with very good nights. When I tell people who've been parents how much sleep we're getting, they say, "That's great." When I've told a few people who've never been parents before, and they hear how much sleep we're getting, they go, "Wow, how could you manage with that?" But we're getting, he's sleeping 3 to 4 hours at a time. So we feel, you know, quite blessed. So I'm telling the story is that I see my mind going in the direction of saying, "Oh, we got it made," And then the wisdom part says, "Well, we don't know yet." That's an interpretation, you know. It's just like the first 2 weeks. Who knows how this is going to develop? So there is this, you know, the sense of, "Oh, well, I don't really know yet." You know, I'm not going to settle on that as a conclusion. So to be careful about the conclusions and the assumptions we make is part of living wisely. And to notice what is an assumption, what is a conclusion, and upon what evidence do we have that this to be true? Another little story. I've told this a lot, but I apologize. But when my first son was about two years old, there was a period of time where my wife and I had developed this practice that when he was being outrageous in some way, that, you know, I was ready to tear my hair out or something, my wife, or we would look at each other, and one of us would say to the other, "We're having one of those kinds of days." And that was enough. Then I just feel settled very quickly. "Oh, it's one of those days." Because the psyche was operating as if, "This is forever. This is it. We have this juvenile delinquent." You know, and I saw the writing on the wall, and, you know, I was visiting him in St. Quentin, and, you know. But it was just one of those days. And, you know, he goes through these days, you know, periods of balance and imbalance. And just to kind of have that little perspective. It was very wise. The famous story of this man who went to the Sufi master and gave him a ring and said, "I want you to write, inscribe on this ring some wise words. When I'm reminded of it, it helps me live wisely." And so the Sufi master took the ring and he wrote the words, "This too will change." So, you know, the implication of that is that be careful with the assumptions you have, with the conclusions you make, that this is the way it's always going to be. Suzuki Roshi defined Buddhism in three words, the core teachings of Buddhism, at one time. At other times, he probably had other definitions. As you'll see, he had to have other definitions by the definition he gave. And the definition he gave in three words for Buddhism is, "Not always so." It's not always so. So to be careful with our conclusions. So the first aspect of wisdom is training, learn to see things as they are. And that's what Vipassana practice is essentially about, is to develop the stability and calmness within ourselves and the clarity of seeing and the ability to question what's there. So we don't take the obvious for granted, but we're questioning, what is this? deeply, looking deeply. What's deeply going on here? What's behind the surface? What's actually here? So that's one aspect of wisdom, is the wisdom of seeing things as they are. Another very, very important aspect of wisdom is in seeing how things are, is also to see how they could be, how they could be different. And this is important for practice, that practice points to a new possibility of how to live in your life. To notice, see how things are, you might see how attached you are to certain things. And to see that there's a possibility, potential to not be attached, a potential for finding the peace of non-attachment. To see that possibility. And a wise life, wisdom involves also seeing, having a vision of what's possible. Without some vision of what's possible, I believe there is no spiritual practice. Now, as soon as we have a vision, however, you have to be wise about how you hold it. Because some people then hold on to the vision and never practice. They use it as their safeguard, their security. Some people just keep getting inspired by the vision of a possibility. They go to endless talks, but they never actually, it's like reading a menu. You know, you never order the food. Some people are always looking into the future to what's going to happen, that they really miss the present moment. Some people have a vision and then judge themselves. Oh, I'm not living up to what's possible, therefore I'm X, Y, and Z. So we have to be careful how we hold a vision. But part of a wise life is, I believe, to have some vision of what's possible. Having a vision of what's possible then gives a person a sense of purpose in their life. And I believe a part of a wise life is to have a sense of purpose, a direction that we're going. And so part of that involves doing the kind of reflective work for oneself, exploration, to find what is a suitable purpose for your life. What is a purpose that you want to organize your life around? And you can certainly have many purposes. It's also possible to have a central purpose around which you're going to organize the rest of your life. And if you don't do that for yourself, then I think for many people in our culture, our culture, our society, our advertising industry will provide you with a central organizing principle. I had this fantasy a week or two ago of somehow we'd raise a lot of money for the next Super Bowl. And I don't know, you need like a few $100,000 for 30 seconds for advertisement. Is that how much? It's a lot of money, right? So we have to do big fundraising. And then we would pay for a 30-second slot. And we had this beautiful, you know, very captivating, very inspiring kind of, you know, commercial that we put on and really get people's attention. And the commercial, the message of the commercial would be, don't buy anything. and instead, spend some time with your family, go do some reflective time, you know, sacred leisure, and go be of service in your community. So a sense of purpose. The part of a wise life is to have a sense of purpose. So see things how they are as part of, to see what is possible, explore what's possible, and then to have some sense of purpose towards that possibility. Once you have a sense of purpose, then you can talk about what is helpful and what is unhelpful for the purposes of attaining that purpose, of following through on that. The classic expression is what is skillful and what is unskillful. And that is an element of discernment, being able to discern clearly. Not just simply see how things are, but to discern distinctions and differences, to discern value between what is valuable, what is helpful, and what is not helpful. The ability to discern connections between things, the connection and consequences, the cause and effect relationships between things. To see if I do X, that's supportive or that's helpful for the purposes that I want to follow through on. To see that living an ethical life has consequences, or not living an ethical life has consequences, to discern those consequences and how they support the meditation practice, for example, or deeper inquiry, deeper looking into our life. To see that, to discern that, to see the cause and effect relationships, to see if I do X, that tends to produce Y, that supports the possibility of Y, something, you know, Y and Z happening. So the ability to be discerning then becomes a very important part of Buddhist training. Actually, it's partly Buddhist training is a training in cultivating our discernment, becoming a more discerning person. The bad news about that is that it involves work, effort. And some people would rather have their spiritual life spoon-fed to them. And actually, so this criticism that I've received, and Vipassana teachers have received from my Zen friends, is we teach too much. We say too much. We explain too much. And from a Zen point of view, you shouldn't say so much. Because you don't want to spoon feed people. One Zen teacher says, like giving baby food to people. What you want to do is let them discover on their own and create the conditions that help them support and discover on their own. But you want to be very careful you don't teach so much for anybody. And if you end up teaching too much in Zen, your eyebrows go really long. I think it's like Pinocchio's nose goes really long. So, so the effort to become discerning, a more discerning kind of person, to look at our experience, look at the conclusions in our mind, look at our assumptions, look at our ideals, look at our relationships to the people around us, and be discerning about them. Make distinctions. Look more deeply. What's really going on here? What are the consequences? What are the results? What's really going on here? To do that work, to do the effort. And I think, again, you if you don't order from the menu is not going to do you any good. If you don't actually put the practice to work, the practice is not going to do any good. And that requires some kind of effort, applying oneself in some way or other. So to be discerning, and so that's why one of my favorite translations now of wisdom is discernment, cultivating ability to be discerning. And I think that it's very common. This is a generalization, but a generalization is that spiritual people tend to generalize, and live in the world of generalizations, and. Practice is supposed to help us become more discerning so we don't just generalize too easily, but actually look more carefully what's actually going on here in the specifics. So that's part of the function of mindfulness, to become more discerning. I like the word discernment as one of the translations of prajna, panya, because it's one of the five faculties. And the five faculties, faculty is a mental faculty or inner faculty that we have that we have to apply and develop and cultivate. It's a capacity we have. So in this sense, wisdom as a faculty is not the understanding you've acquired, but rather it's a capacity we have to act in the world in a certain way, for the mind to be engaged in a certain way. And so I think it works better to translate it as discernment, to be discerning, than it does in having knowledge or having understanding. Because it's an ongoing process. Wisdom is not there's not an end result in wisdom, now you have it. But rather it's a constant inquiry, a constant discernment of our life as we go through it, to be discerning. So as a faculty, we have the capacity to be discerning. Part of Buddhist practice is to cultivate that faculty until it becomes actually a power, a bala in Pali, a power that we have that really supports us. So, and we discover, we cultivate discernment by being discerning. So in meditation practice, how are we discerning in our meditation practice? I know there are some people I've talked to who aren't really that discerning about their meditation practice. I've known people who spent years and years kind of having faith-based practice. There's kind of a lot of faith that this is a good thing to do. But they never really look deeply at what's really going on for them when they meditate, and what are the results of their meditation. And sooner or later, you want to look a little bit. What are the results? Well, how is this benefiting me? Is it serving the purpose that I have? Do I have a real sense of purpose? Now, some people are looking at the, you know, they're measuring their meditation practice too quickly. It's like, if, you know, you plant a corn seed in the ground and the little sprouts through the ground. You have one little leaf kind of sticking out of the ground and you pull out the leaf to see how well the plant's growing. Or you tug on it and you destroy it. You have to leave things alone also, but, you know, after a couple of years or a few months or something, to have some discernment. What's happening here? Is this useful for me? Is it useful for me to meditate first thing in the morning? Maybe it is. Or maybe it's not. Maybe for you it's better to meditate in the afternoon or in the evening. To be discerning about what's useful, how to meditate. Be discerning how long should your sittings be, your meditations be. And part of that then is a process of trial and error. To try for a while to meditate for 20 minutes, or 30 minutes, or 45 minutes, and see what the differences is in the complex ecology of your life. What do different lengths of meditation time do for you in terms of supporting you for the purpose that you're approaching your spiritual life? And to take some risks, to experiment a little bit. Okay, what would it be like to try 45 minutes for a while, for 2-3 months? And then to see what the benefits are. And you might find that the benefits so outweigh the disadvantages that you'll make it a regular part of your life to sit every day on a regular basis. So this is a process of discerning what's really going on here. What's a useful way of meditating? Some people haven't really learned well the techniques or the instructions for meditation, and so they're kind of namby-pamby when they sit down. And some people, you know, but then you can also be very particular. Okay, I'm going to try cultivating concentration for a while and do it on my breath. What's that like? Do I have the ability to cultivate concentration? What supports cultivation of concentration? What's helpful for me in doing mindfulness? And be discerning. What's helpful? What's helpful? What's not helpful? What's skillful? What's not skillful? To be discerning of what's going on and have the wisdom to know how to be discerning without the mind being analytical or agitated or constantly preoccupied by the discerning process. That's part of the art. One of the guidelines is, is it helpful to helping the inner life become more peaceful, more still, more quiet, more loving? So is the very process of being discerning being done in a way that's conducive to becoming quieter, stiller, more? And there are different ways of being discerning, of being engaged in that kind of process. It can be agitating and tense with pressure, and it can be very soft in a way that actually lends itself to becoming softer and more gentle in the inner life. As one of the five faculties, discernment is meant to be balanced with what in Pali is called saddha, or shraddha in Sanskrit, which is often translated into English as faith. And maybe it's interesting to look at why faith and wisdom need to be balanced, discernment and faith. However, when we use the word faith as a translation of saddha, all too often I've noticed that it raises a lot of red flags for people. And no way I'm going to get close to faith, or that's a problem for me, or you know. And I think the reason is that here in the West, a lot of people come out of their own Western religious backgrounds and assume that Buddhism is a religion like their religion of birth. And therefore, since both of them are religions, they must be similar. And so we have similar categories, and therefore if Buddhists use the word faith, it must be the same thing what it means faith in my religion. And, you know, I don't want that anymore. I was burned by that kind of faith, or whatever the attitude has been, or that's supposed to mean I'm supposed to kind of believe something without evidence, just kind of believe it out of faith. But faith is a faculty that we all have. Saddha is a faculty. It's a capacity we have. And so the question is, do we want to exercise that capacity? And is there a way of exercising it so it's supportive for spiritual life, for meditative life, for following through on this purpose that we've set for our life? And perhaps I'll experiment with you with an analogy, metaphor for this that maybe is helpful and maybe it will be disaster. The Buddha belonged to the warrior class in ancient India. He was a warrior. And sometimes it might be helpful to look at how a warrior, a soldier, a fighter, maybe in the best qualities of being a warrior, would approach being in battle or being in training oneself to be a warrior. And the five faculties of faith, of energy, of wisdom, of mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom can be seen as the five faculties that need to be developed for someone to be a successful warrior. So, and here, I don't think faith then means, you know, faith in some supreme deity that's going to protect you or some supernatural thing. For a warrior, or maybe for modern words, we would say, you know, someone involved in a sport or any kind of activity, one of the primary qualities that needs to be strong is a sense of conviction or a sense of confidence. A person would not be a good warrior, unless the person had some degree of confidence. And that confidence needs to be matched with discernment. If a warrior just has confidence and goes into battle with a confidence, he or she, and no discernment, he or she would probably not survive for very long. You want a warrior who's very discerning. So maybe, you know, we don't like warrior kind of battle kind of imagery for our spirituality here in the West, though classically that was often the case. It was used that way, those kinds of images. Maybe for us, maybe the idea of a guide. If we wanted a guide to take us into the wild, uncharted wilderness someplace in the Amazon or something. And I've been to the Amazon once, and I went into the jungle away from everything, like 100 feet. And what amazed me was how incredibly monotonous or homogenous, the jungle got immediately. Everything looked exactly the same. So you go 100 feet in, you know, and I didn't know which direction to go anymore because all the markers I had, it was all the same. And I'd only gone 100 feet or something, anyway, so you go, if you want to go into the wilderness with a guide, you want a guide who has confidence, and you want someone who's discerning. So the five faculties is that confidence and discernment need to work together. The image that's given is confidence is a blind giant, and discernment is a lame person with good eyesight. And so the lame person can't walk. And so the lame person has to go be carried in the shoulders of the giant who can't see. And then the giant helps, the lame person helps the giant to walk. And so our ability to be discerning needs to be matched or supported by confidence that this is useful, conviction, confidence in the purpose for which we're doing it. And that has a very important element. Confidence in the purpose for which we're doing it. Confidence in our ability to attain the purpose. Confidence in our ability that it's a useful purpose to follow. Some people have the wisdom or the insight to see their attachments, what they're clinging to in their life. But they don't have the wisdom to see that it's valuable to let go of that attachment. Or they don't have enough confidence in the alternative to clinging. If we had a lot of confidence in the alternative to clinging, it'd probably be easy to let go of our clinging. So it's one thing to see our clinging. It's another thing to have great confidence in the alternative to clinging, non-clinging. So to have confidence and conviction in that is very helpful. So I imagine, you know, like a guide going into the Amazon jungle. You have to have enough confidence and conviction that being tense in trying to find your way in the jungle is not helpful. That's better to be relaxed and alert. See, the alternative is better. So wisdom. Wisdom and faith, wisdom and confidence, conviction, the exercise of discernment, reflecting deeply about the purpose we have for our lives, getting support from other people and texts and from our learning, but what might be the purpose for our life and what might be the ways of supporting that purpose, what it means to be a human being, and to spend time reflecting deeply on our own, to actually give ourselves the reflective time, the idle time, the sacred time, not only to reflect, but to allow the innate, native, natural healing process, opening process, the natural wellsprings of wisdom and compassion and love to have a chance to bubble up and surface, I think are all part of a wise life. So may all of you be discerning and wise, and may all of you find a way to have mindfulness and meditation and concentration and love and compassion, faith and conviction support you so your life feels more fulfilled and happier and more at peace. At the minimum, may you discover the capacity not to live a life without conflict. So, thank you very much.